This recording is a production of Faith Builders Educational Programs. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Week 2019, held at Faith Builders from July 29 through August 2.
Good morning. The devotional this morning, our time of singing in Rollins yesterday, is a really good lead-in and introduction for today's session. A Chinese painter was asked by the emperor to paint his favorite goat. The artist asked for the goat. He said he needed to study it before he could paint it. 2 years went by, and the emperor is getting impatient. This is his favorite goat, by the way. And so he asked the artist, can I have my goat back? And the artist says, certainly. And then the emperor has another thought, and he says, well, where's the painting? Where's my painting? So the artist said, well, I haven't started that yet. But then the artist, as the story goes, picked up a nearby brush and on a piece of paper with 8 quick strokes painted the most perfect goat in the history of Chinese painting. The Chinese tell that story to make a point that when we know the essence of something, that's when we're able to draw it, when we're able to speak it, when we're able to teach it, when we're able to live it. Maybe it's their way of talking about something being on your heart. And the artist project is similar to our project here in these sessions. That is, we're looking for foundational texts that capture something of that essence of Christianity, the Christian worldview, especially those that are applicable for our classrooms. Texts that need to be on our hearts, that we've taken the time to get to know, so that it just flows out of us. Let's review our first two texts. The fear of the Lord is?
The fear of wisdom.
You shall
love the Lord.
We have two more in this session, and these two texts are related, but they're not the same. I'm excited about talking about these texts because they form a basis, a foundation for connecting what it is we do every day in our classrooms, where we spend our time and energy, connecting that with the Creator of the universe. And as I think about these two texts, I'm reminded of something that started for me in fourth grade. I was in public school and was introduced to science fair. And that first year, I think I built a simple little telegraph with 2 buzzers, a battery, and 2 switches or something like that. But I was hooked. And so over the next number of years, I really tried to come up with something that I could work on where I could research it, maybe extend what we know in a particular area. And I became very fascinated with this algae, Chlorella pyranodosa. And one of the things that's true about chlorella is that it grows very rapidly as long as it's not in too bright of light. It also has high nutritional value. And so I started dreaming about maybe this would be something that could be grown in third world climes where they need food sources. But the problem is if there's too much sun, it doesn't grow well. And so that was my work, was trying to come up with a way to grow this in bright sunlight. But of course, once you have a lot of this stuff, you still have to face the problem of getting people to eat it. And so that was part of the research as well. And I remember my classmates at school where they were cooperative to a point, but I'd bring mashed potatoes made with chlorella and cookies and so on. I had to do blind tests because if they looked at it, they wouldn't like it. But so I was working with this algae, and as part of the of that, I was able to go to the International Science and Engineering Fair in Albuquerque, New Mexico, in my 11th grade. And I remember being so excited about going there because, you see, I grew up on a farm, and farming was okay, but what I wanted to be was a scientist. I wanted to be a chemist. And don't you know, I saw on the program for the International Science and Engineering Fair that Glenn T. Seaborg was going to be one of the keynote speakers. He was a bit of a hero for me because he had helped to discover around 10 of the elements. And one of the elements, Seaborgium, is named after him. So here I was going to get to see and hear this great chemist. And we come to a banquet evening that he was going to speak. And I remember there was a minister that prayed for the meal. So there was a recognition of a higher power, at least in that respect. And then we get to the highlight, Glenn T. Seaborg speaking, and he begins to talk. And he says how that what he's learning in the laboratory is so exciting. And he says what we're finding out is that we are in this universe that is, right now we're in an expansion cycle. And he says at some point that expansion is going to stop and it's going to start coming back together. And at some point in the way in the future, there's going to be this, I think he called it a great crunch, in which everything, all of us are going to, everything is going to be annihilated. And he just said, I can't wait, I would just rather be at the lab than out here talking to you folks, because so I can keep learning about some of this stuff. And I remember feeling just this palpable sense of, but if that really is the storyline, why do I want to go to the lab? If the destiny of everything is just to recollapse in on itself and nothing is left, all of us are completely gone forever, why would I care to continue studying? And I tell that story to contrast with the two texts that we're going to look at today, that give a basis for engaging with the physical world, for study, studying the creation and doing it with joy, with hope, and with anticipation. Anticipation not for some future annihilation where no longer, or where things just start back over, but an anticipation for the new heavens and new earth where righteousness dwells. So, in order to introduce our third text, we need to return for a moment to the worldview of the ancient Egyptians. And you'll see why in just a bit. At the foundation of their understanding of the world was the idea that every part of our life is governed by a different god. And their stories of the gods and goddesses framed their understanding, their worldview. And so their chief god, their first god or sun god, Atum, it's told, spat out Shu, the god of the air, and Tefnut, the goddess of water and sky. And Tefnut had two children, Geb, the god of the earth, and Nut, god of the sky, and they had four children, Osiris, king of the earth and ultimately of death, Isis, king, the god of life, and this would have been a goddess, and became the wife of Osiris. There was Set, the god of chaos, and their fourth child, Nephthys, the river goddess. Now, the story goes that Set was envious of his brother and so murdered him, dismembered him, and declared himself to be king. And to prevent chaos from winning, Isis re membered, brought back together Osiris's body, resurrected him, and proceeded to give birth to their only son, Horus, the god of healing. Now, these are just a few of the Egyptian gods and goddesses. Every element in nature, the sun, the air, the earth, the Nile, was understood to be in itself a divine force, a god or a goddess. Nature was not an it. It had a life and will of its own. But not just nature, also human functions like writing or the ability to measure had a godlike essence, and in fact was a god. And abstractions like justice or kingship or order. And so the Egyptian people had, in addition to these, I'll just put up here a list of the major Egyptian deities, and no, I'm not expecting you to read that. Instead of going through pages and pages that you could read, I just shrunk it down to where you could see. This is the list of the major Egyptian deities, all of these assigned to some different aspect of nature or of the world. But in addition to the major Egyptian deities, there were minor Egyptian deities. And so here's a few, and here's a few more. You can tell it's more because it says page 2. And then there's page 3 and page 4 and page 5. So a page of major deities, 5 pages of minor deities. Why go through all of that here this morning? Because it is in this context that the words of the Shema hold particular power. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. This is a major shift from the multitude of gods in the Egyptian mindset to one God. It took the Jewish people hundreds of years to really make this shift. So, our third text, the Lord is one. Now you might say, okay, that makes sense for this to be a text to put in the schoolroom of the ancient Hebrews, since they needed to get this. But what about our classrooms today? Since a belief in one God is firmly established, why should it be one of our 6 texts? Here's why I think it ought to be. It's not because we divide our lives into all these different pieces and assign a different God to those pieces like the Egyptians did. But it's because we have a tendency, it seems to me, to divide life not into many categories, but into 2. Those 2 would be the sacred things and the secular. The categories of church and maybe the categories of school. And the one category we know where God fits, the sacred category of missions and preaching and teaching. But how does God fit in the world of the physical, of farming and mechanics? Let's try to think about this with some illustrations. So if we were to make a Christian map of reality, that is, draw a map in which we try to capture everything that is real, it might look something like this. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth and all the things that are in the earth. And God said, "Let us make man." And if we were to draw a triangle around all of that, maybe that could be our map of reality. There's God, there's the heavens and the earth, there's men and women. And the reason we put a triangle around all of it is to indicate not that all is God, but that in Him we live and move and have our being. It's not that we're God, but that in Him we exist. In Him all things were created. In Him all things consist. So trying to capture that unity. So there's the map: God, man, earth. And it's either God or from God. That's all it is. Either God or that which is from God. If we were to try to illustrate the Egyptian worldview, maybe it would look like there's us, but then above us are all these gods with some different aspect of reality attached to them. So we have what I would call a Christian map of reality, an Egyptian map of reality. But what's this map that I said maybe we have a tendency toward today? Let's try to capture that idea of the sacred and the secular map, where we're not sure how they fit together. That might look like this. There's the realm of God, and then there's the realm of the earth. And then there's us, where we're living some of our lives on the earth and some in the realm of God. I remember talking with a businessman. He was a very successful businessman, but he had stopped doing what he was doing and went to work at a ministry, a mission somewhere. And I asked him, why is it that you stopped being a businessman and went into voluntary service? And he said, it's because I had no way of thinking about what I was doing as a businessman for the kingdom of God. And so I wanted to be sure that I got into something that was of God. That's the split that we're talking about. And that's why I think this passage, "The Lord is One," is so significant for us as well. In the words of Virginia Stem Owens, this world is holy, all of it, having come from a holy hand. Why did we ever separate it into sacred and secular? Was it so that we would have a place to feel safe from holiness? The Lord is One. Therefore, live all of life for God and to God. The Lord is one. That says something about God, something that is true about God, but it also says something about everything else, that there's nothing that didn't come from Him, and there's nothing that shouldn't be outside of His rule. So whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do it all for the glory of God. From this perspective, whether it's listening to a friend or witnessing or teaching or holding a baby or helping a neighbor or mowing the grass or eating a meal or playing volleyball, taking a shower, it can all be done for the glory of God. So, putting it together for a job description, it is the teacher's duty to model how to live all of life under the Lordship of Christ. The Lord is one. How do we help our students remember, bring back together the oneness of it all? I see some of you missed that, so I'll go back for a moment. It is the teacher's duty to model how to live all of life under the Lordship of Christ. So again, I want to give five ways that we can maybe work toward this in the classroom. First of all, would be to develop a class prayer or creed that brings these ideas together, the sacred, the secular, all of life under the Lordship of Christ. And I say, develop a class prayer. I'm thinking here that maybe this is something you would do as a class. It may be something along the lines of this prayer from John Bailey. Lord and maker of all things, from whose creative power the first light came forth, who didst look upon the world's first morning and see that it was good, I praise thee for this light that now streams through my windows to rouse me to the life of another day. I praise thee for the life that stirs within me. I praise thee for the bright and beautiful world into which I go. I praise thee for earth and sea and sky, for scudding cloud and singing bird. I praise thee for the work thou hast given me to do. I praise thee for all that thou hast given me to fill my leisure hours. I praise thee for my friends. I praise thee for music and books and good company and all pure pleasures. Notice that effort to bring all of life into his relationship with the Lord. So this would be something we could do. What's a prayer or a statement of belief and affirmation that maybe you could say every morning or sing every morning for a quarter or semester. A second way to remember the Lord as one would be to memorize and use a Christian map of reality. I've already given you one. Actually, the best ones would be one you would come up with yourself. How could you take all that is and make a map of it? How would you draw that? I'll give you another one. This is one that I use a lot in my classes. I like ones that you can draw quickly, but also have the possibility of expanding into some complexity. So I'll try to show both here. So here's the initial map of reality. Notice there's three parts. There's the Creator, and I put this at the center to indicate that God is the source of all. And then there is the creation, that which the Creator has made. And then there's the creation's makings. Whether this would be a beaver dam or a bridge. Creator, creation, creation's makings. And I think that all of reality can fit in one of these places, one of these categories. And I find it interesting and helpful to actually decide where.
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. Order online at www.christianlearning.org or call 877-222-4769.